We would like to send out a special thanks to Anna Luisa for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Anna Luisa makes beautiful, sustainable jewelry at fair prices. For 10% off, go to shop.analuisa.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. Enjoy the show. December 17th, 1993. Merced, California. 27-year-old Paul Armstrong, a tow truck operator employed by RTS Towing, vanishes without explanation from his home. Later that day, 34-year-old Stephen Lombard, another tow truck operator from the same company, goes to the towing yard to pick up his paycheck before he also disappears and his abandoned pickup truck is found in a Kmart parking lot the following morning. Over 15 years later, the owner of RTS Towing, Randall Wright, becomes a person of interest in the disappearance of his 50-year-old estranged wife, Karen Wright, who vanishes from their vacation home in Mexico. There is suspicion that Randall might have been involved in all three of these disappearances, but no trace of any of the victims is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring not one, not two, but three missing persons cases. The 1993 disappearances of Paul Armstrong and Stephen Lombard, as well as the 2009 disappearance of Karen Wright. And I think it's safe to say that this might be one of the most bizarre stories we've ever featured. It's not uncommon for our podcast to cover multiple cold cases on the same episode, but the circumstances of how these three disappearances wound up being connected are incredibly unusual. Paul Armstrong and Stephen Lombard were both employed as tow truck operators at a company called RTS Towing, and they both happened to go missing on the exact same date, which seems like one hell of a coincidence. But the issue is that in spite of having the same employer, Paul and Stephen were casual acquaintances at best who were not close friends, and at the time he went missing, Paul was also sidelined on disability because of a leg injury he had suffered on the job. While Stephen disappeared after paying a visit to his workplace, Paul just seemed to vanish without explanation from his home, so there was no conclusive evidence to prove that their cases were connected. For many years, it seems like investigators were left completely stumped about what happened, but in February of 2009, they started looking at the whole thing in a different light when the owner of RTS Towing, Randall Wright, found himself at the center of another missing persons case. This time, Randall's estranged wife, Karen Wright, who had filed for divorce from him months earlier, disappeared from the couple's vacation home in Mexico, and Randall would raise a number of eyebrows by not reporting her missing for days. Randall would serve a bit of time in jail for other unrelated criminal charges, and naturally, investigators started looking at the possibility that he might have played some sort of role in the disappearances of his two former employees. The only thing we do know is that Paul Armstrong, Stephen Lombard, and Karen Wright are all still missing persons to this day, and there's still a lot of uncertainty about whether all three of these cases are linked to each other, so we're going to try and make some sense of this perplexing situation on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearances of Paul Armstrong and Stephen Lombard. Thank you. Our story begins in 1993 in Merced, California, a city which is located in Merced County in the San Joaquin Valley area, which had a population of around 60,000 people at that time. Our first victim is 27-year-old Paul Armstrong, who lives in Merced at a residence on West 25th Street, alongside his girlfriend, Colleen Connor. Paul is employed as a tow truck operator at a company called RTS Towing, but has spent the past 2 months on disability after his left leg was pinned in a towing accident in October. Paul now has a brace on his leg and requires crutches for walking, and he is also taking daily pain medication while he recovers. On the morning of December the 17th, Colleen left their residence at 7:45 a.m. to head to work, and would claim that Paul was still curled up in bed when she last saw him. Approximately 1 hour later, Paul's stepbrother, Ray Skeels, stopped by the residence, but was surprised to discover that Paul was not there. Even though Paul's house keys, a pack of cigarettes, and his lighter were missing, his wallet had been left behind. Paul had a lunch date scheduled with Colleen later that day, but he wound up missing it, and when he failed to resurface, a missing persons report was officially filed for him. However, Paul's loved ones were soon shocked to learn that another tow truck operator from RTS Towing had gone missing on the exact same day. The employee in question was 34-year-old Stephen Lombard, who lived with his wife Louise Lombard and his two sons on Langtree Avenue, just northwest of Merced. Stephen was not scheduled to work on December the 17th, but he wanted to stop by his place of employment to pick up his most recent paycheck before he met up with Louise for Christmas shopping later that day. The RTS towing yard was located on Yosemite Park Way, and it's been reported that Stephen was seen there at around 10 a.m. as he attempted to get his paycheck, but was told he was unable to pick it up because of a clerical error. What happened to him next is a big mystery, but Stephen did not meet up with his wife as planned and never returned home. The following morning, Stephen's maroon and white 1965 Ford F-20 pickup truck was found abandoned in the parking lot of a Kmart located on Martin Luther King Jr. Way in the southern section of Merced. A full cup of coffee was in the holder, the windows were rolled down, the driver's side door was unlocked, and the truck's keys were in the ignition. There was no sign of Stephen anywhere, and since he considered his truck to be a prized possession, it seemed very out of character for him to leave it unlocked, and investigators were unable to recover any usable fingerprints from the truck. At first, Paul's disappearance was investigated by the Merced Police Department, but since Stephen technically lived outside the city limits, his case would be handled by the Merced County Sheriff's Office. Needless to say, it seemed like too much of a coincidence that two employees from the same company would happen to go missing on the same day, but the situation struck everyone as odd because Paul and Stephen did not appear to know each other that well. They were not close friends and did not have any history of hanging out or socializing outside of work, so it seemed very unlikely that they would have decided to take off and go anywhere together. And while Stephen could actually be placed at RTS Towing on December the 17th, Paul appeared to vanish from his home, so there was nothing to indicate that the two men had ever crossed paths on that particular date. However, Paul had supposedly told people that he believed his co-workers might be engaging in illegal activity, and his girlfriend Colleen said that he had recently been depressed. While she attributed his depression to his leg injury, she now wondered if something else might have been going on. Stephen's wife Louise also reported some odd behavior on his part prior to his disappearance, as she said that he appeared to be scared of something, but never shared any details about what was wrong. At one point, Stephen suddenly made this statement to her out of nowhere, quote, "I'm not going to leave you, I'll never leave you, no matter what," end quote. The owner of RTS Towing was 43-year-old Randall Wright, who was questioned by the authorities, but if he said or did anything to cause investigators to become suspicious of him, they never said so publicly. But it was reported that both men were considered to be missing under suspicious circumstances, and even though a conclusive connection between the two cases could not be established, they were both investigated as homicides. Paul's family would be hit by additional tragedy when Paul's stepbrother, Paul Skeels, the first person who noticed he was missing, would unexpectedly succumb to a fatal heart attack at the age of 40 in July of 1996. For just over 15 years, Paul and Stephen's disappearances would receive sporadic coverage in the local newspaper, the Merced Sun-Star, and while these articles often implied that the investigation had hit a brick wall, their stories would receive a bunch of additional coverage when Randall Wright found himself at the center of another missing persons case. By 2009, Randall was still the owner of RTS Towing and lived at a residence located on the same property. On February the 12th, Randall contacted the Merced County Sheriff's Office and summoned them to his home to report that his estranged 50-year-old wife, Karen Wright, had gone missing. 4 months earlier, in October of 2008, the Wrights had filed for divorce after 12 years of marriage, and they were legally separated at this point. Since the couple owned a pair of vacation homes in San Felipe, Mexico, this would become a bone of contention in the divorce proceedings. Randall claimed that on February the 9th, both he and Karen met up at one of the vacation homes because she wanted to take some photographs there. Since they both arrived in separate vehicles, Randall said that he spent the night with another friend in San Felipe, but when he returned to the vacation home the following morning, he was surprised to discover that Karen's abandoned Hummer was parked in the driveway with her Basset Hound dogs inside. Even though the windows were partially rolled down, and food and water were left inside the vehicle to keep the dogs nourished, Randall found it unusual that Karen would have left them alone. So Randall said he let the Basset Hounds out of the Hummer and spent the next 6 hours searching for Karen with the assistance of some of their neighbors. He had no luck finding her, and all attempts to reach Karen on her cell phone were unsuccessful, so Randall took the dogs and drove back to Merced with them and contacted the Merced County Sheriff's Office after he arrived. Of course, since Karen had gone missing in San Felipe, her disappearance would not fall within the Sheriff's Office's jurisdiction, and red flags went up when they made contact with the Mexican authorities and learned that Randall had never reported Karen missing. When asked to account for this, Randall claimed that when he last saw Karen on February the 9th, she told him she would do something that he would, quote-unquote, never get over, and he wouldn't be able to return to San Felipe. For this reason, when Randall discovered that Karen was missing the following day, he initially assumed that she was playing some sort of trick on him. When he couldn't find Karen, Randall said he got in touch with a San Felipe attorney named Francisco Sosa, who advised him that Karen would need to be missing for at least 3 or 4 days before the Mexican authorities would take any action. Since Randall needed to drive back to Merced to deal with some work-related issues, he left without contacting the San Felipe police and assumed that Sosa would later file a missing persons report on his behalf. Well, investigators soon learned that when Karen filed for divorce, she alleged that Randall was abusive and had a history of violence, as he had committed such acts as breaking her hand and ripping chunks of her hair out. Karen also wrote, quote, "He always tells me he could kill me and nobody would know. He has joined a motorcycle club now and says if I do any harm to him, like divorce, the gang will take care of me so he won't have blood on his hands," end quote. For his part, Randall claimed these allegations were untrue and that Karen was delusional and had actually been abusive towards him. The last time Karen was confirmed to be alive was when she spoke to her mother on the phone on February the 9th and said she was heading to her vacation home in San Felipe. She had heard that Randall made some construction additions to the residence without her knowledge or consent, which violated a court order as he was not permitted to perform any construction on their homes until the divorce was finalized. This seemed to contradict Randall's story that he and Karen had made the mutual decision to meet up there. Only one day after he informed the authorities about Karen's disappearance, Randall would contact the California Highway Patrol about a separate matter, as he wanted to report that his Ford Explorer Sport Track pickup truck had been stolen. However, investigators would soon learn that the Sport Track was being held at a self-storage unit in the town of Oroville. It was registered under Karen's name, as 2 months earlier, Karen had asked her sister to drive it there, something that Randall would have known about when he reported the truck missing. As a result, Randall would be arrested and charged with making a false stolen car report. While he was being held in the Merced County Jail, Randall was also charged with felony auto theft in relation to an incident involving a stolen, black Mercedes-Benz G55. Randall had leased the Mercedes from an auto dealership in Fresno, but stopped making payments on it. For this reason, Randall was forced to return the vehicle to the dealership in December of 2008, but it wound up being stolen from there a short time later, and investigators uncovered evidence that Randall had taken the Mercedes to an audio installation business in Merced to have its low-jack stolen vehicle recovery system disabled. While he was in jail, Randall had a phone conversation with his current girlfriend, Teresa Hutt, which was recorded, and he could be heard saying, quote, Black needs to take a permanent vacation. Well, sure enough, the missing Mercedes was soon found at a condo Teresa owned in San Felipe. In August of 2009, in order to avoid going to trial, Randall agreed to a plea deal in which he would plead no contest to the charges of felony auto theft and embezzlement of a leased vehicle and receive a 6 months jail sentence as well as 3 years probation. Shortly thereafter, investigators publicly stated that Karen's disappearance had been ruled to be a homicide, and while they believed that Randall knew what happened to her, they stopped short of calling him a suspect and only classified him as a person of interest. Randall's legal troubles would prompt the American Automobile Association to end their contract with RTS Towing, and he was forced to close down his business for good and file for bankruptcy. This prompted Randall to file a $15 million lawsuit against Merced County, alleging that the sheriff's office's false accusations against him had ruined his reputation and his business, but the suit wound up being dismissed by a Superior Court judge. As you might have expected, investigators started re-examining the disappearances of Paul Armstrong and Stephen Lombard to explore any possible links with Randall. But believe it or not, there was another odd incident which had taken place under his watch nearly 3 decades earlier. Randall's marriage to Karen was his third one, and back in 1982, he had been married to another woman named Judy Larson and had a 6-year-old stepson named Aaron. On July the 9th of that year, Aaron had drowned in a neighbor's pool in Merced County while Randall was babysitting him. Even though Aaron's death was ruled to be an accident, the suspicion surrounding Randall's involvement in these other disappearances compelled investigators to exhume Aaron's body in May of 2010. Aaron was examined by a forensic pathologist, but it does not sound like any new evidence was found to indicate foul play, so the boy was soon reburied. As for the disappearances of Paul and Stephen, the April 11th, 2009 edition of the Merced Sun-Star reported that a search warrant which was issued to obtain Randall's DNA had been made public, and it contained some surprising new information. According to the warrant, a man named Jack Malone, who was described as a quote-unquote witness in the investigation, had shared a story about having seen Paul and Stephen enter a shed on the property for RTS Towing on December the 17th, 1993. They were accompanied by Randall Wright and another man named Gary Barker, and according to Malone, he soon saw Wright and Barker exit the shed and lock it behind them, but he never saw Paul or Stephen again. A short time later, Randall drove his Lexus sedan into the shed and closed the doors. When he drove out of the shed, Randall then left the property and did not return for about 4 hours. Malone told investigators that he believed Randall was angry with Paul and Stephen because they had filed a complaint with California's Employment Development Department. Unfortunately, this one article is the only source I could find which contains this information, and I've never seen any follow-up on it, though Randall Wright has never officially been named as a suspect in either of those disappearances. It does not look like there have been any new developments in the investigation for the past decade, so Paul Armstrong, Stephen Lombard, and Karen Wright all continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to Ana Luisa, as we are very excited that they are now supporting The Trail Went Cold. I want to discuss this new brand, as Ana Luisa began with a simple but clear-cut idea, that high-quality, unique, and affordable jewelry shouldn't cost the planet. Ana Luisa crafts jewelry such as earrings, necklaces, and rings with the planet in mind. All of these pieces are 100% carbon neutral and 100% water neutral, and their fair prices start as low as $39. They have a large selection if you either want to shop for yourself or shop for the perfect gift for someone else, and new jewelry collections are always released every Friday. When Ana Luisa started supporting our show, they let me pick out some pieces which were sent to me. These included a gold initial necklace with the letter R on it for Robin, as well as a gold nameplate necklace which read thank you. I'm not ordinarily someone who wears necklaces, but I'm pleased to say that I now wear the R necklace with pride, and plan to give the thank you necklace to someone special. It's worth noting that Mother's Day took place only a few days before this episode's release, so I'd highly recommend Ana Luisa if you're looking for gift ideas, not just for Mother's Day, but holidays, birthdays, and special occasions as well. And I'm pleased to say that we have an Ana Luisa deal for you, where you can go treat yourself and your loved ones by using our promo code COLD to get 10% off. I absolutely recommend them. They are a great brand which makes beautiful, sustainable jewelry. So to get 10% off, go to shop.analuisa.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. Once again, that's shop.analuisa.com/cold and the promo code is COLD. Thank you and enjoy the rest of this episode. So when you're investigating a missing persons case and a potential suspect pops up on the radar, it's not that uncommon to look into their background and find out that they might have had involvement in some other unsolved cold cases. But this situation is pretty unique, because we have a series of disappearances that took place just over 15 years apart and do not appear to have anything in common, but the one link between them is Randall Wright. If this episode was only covering the disappearance of Karen Wright, then there wouldn't be much of a mystery figuring out what happened. We have a woman who vanished only 4 months after filing for divorce from a husband whom she accused of being violent and abusive, and he even flat out acknowledges that he was the last known person to see her alive. And of course, he did not even bother to report her missing until a few days after he last saw her, and did so in an entirely different country with a law enforcement agency who did not even have jurisdiction. But while cases in which people are responsible for the disappearances of their estranged spouse are sadly common, how did the disappearances of Paul Armstrong and Stephen Lombard fit into this whole thing? Now, these two men went missing years before Randall Wright even married Karen, so there's obviously no connection between those cases, but it just seems like one hell of a coincidence that no less than 3 people with a connection to Randall would happen to go missing. And 2 of these disappearances involved employees from Randall's company who went missing on the exact same date. And we also have the drowning of Randall's 6-year-old stepson way back in 1982, and while it's possible that may have been nothing more than a legitimate accident, you can understand the concern. If Randall was a truly innocent man who had nothing to do with any of these disappearances or deaths, then he has to be one of the most cursed and unlucky individuals ever. From what I can tell, when Stephen Lombard and Paul Armstrong originally went missing, their cases did get a decent amount of coverage in the Merced Sun-Star and other local California newspapers, but there just didn't seem to be much in the way of leads at all. The Sun-Star would keep publishing articles about the cases over the next 15 years, but they gave off the impression that no one had the faintest idea of what happened to either of these men, and it wasn't even clear if their disappearances were actually connected or just a very odd coincidence. But once Karen Wright's disappearance started getting media coverage in 2009, Paul and Stephen's cases would get a lot of extra exposure in the spotlight, as virtually every article would make mention of Randall Wright's connection to them. Now, it must be clarified that Randall has never been formally named as a suspect in any of these cases, and even though investigators have openly stated that they believe he knows what happened to Karen, he is only technically considered to be a person of interest in her disappearance. Another complication is that Karen went missing in San Felipe, Mexico, so her case would technically be under the jurisdiction of the Mexican authorities, and they aren't exactly known for having the best track record when it comes to investigating cases involving missing or murdered foreign nationals. And since she vanished on Mexican soil, Karen Wright does not even have a profile page on any of the major American missing persons websites, such as the Charlie Project, the Doe Network, and Namus. So who knows how much effort the Mexican authorities have spent trying to find Karen this past decade? I mentioned earlier that in August of 2009, Randall agreed to plead no contest to the charges of felony auto theft and embezzlement of a leased vehicle in exchange for a 6-month jail sentence, because if he had gone to trial for these charges and been found guilty, he could have faced a sentence of up to 3 years in prison. However, I can't be certain when or if Randall began serving a sentence, as there were a number of delays and continuances which allowed him to remain free on bond up until at least early 2011. At one point, Randall even attempted to withdraw his no-contest plea, claiming that he was pressured to take the plea by his attorney while impaired by the prescription medication he was taking, though the judge later rejected this argument. I have to assume that Randall did serve a sentence at some point, but there hasn't been any news about him in over a decade. I don't know what he's up to today, but he would currently be in his early 70s. Since the circumstances of how Karen went missing seem less mysterious than the disappearances of the two missing tow truck operators, I suppose I'll start off by discussing her case. Randall did admit that he was with Karen at their vacation home on San Felipe on the last day she was confirmed to be alive, but he says she told him that she was going to do something he would, quote-unquote, never get over. So I think Randall was trying to imply that Karen had staged her own disappearance in order to make everyone believe he had murdered her. Of course, no one really believed that, as Karen left everything behind, including her two Basset Hound dogs, whom she completely adored. Randall's explanation for not reporting Karen missing until after he returned to the U.S. is that a Mexican attorney named Francisco Sosa had told him that they would not take a report until Karen had been missing for at least 3 or 4 days. So Randall assumed that Sosa was going to file the report on his behalf. But I'd really be curious to know if this story was ever verified, or if Francisco Sosa even exists for that matter. The fact of the matter is that it was much safer for Randall to play the role of the concerned spouse and report Karen's disappearance to the Merced County Sheriff's Office while he was back on American soil, because he knew they wouldn't have any jurisdiction over the investigation. We know Randall would soon get into other legal trouble for the business involving the stolen Mercedes and filing a false police report for the non-existent theft of a Sport Track pickup truck. Randall filed the report only one day after he reported Karen missing, which seems pretty brazen, given that he was already going to be under a microscope at this point, and the truck had already been taken to a self-storage unit months earlier and was being held there under Karen's name. I almost wonder if Randall was being too clever for his own good and was attempting to plant the false narrative that since Karen had abandoned her own Hummer at the residence in San Felipe, she somehow traveled to Randall's residence in Merced and stole his truck in order to disappear of her own accord. Now, it turned out that Randall had another girlfriend at the time named Teresa Hutt, who was hiding the Mercedes he had stolen from the dealership in Fresno at her condo in San Felipe. The Merced County Sheriff's Office actually went down to Mexico and attempted to arrest and charge Teresa for her role in this whole scheme, but she refused to sign a waiver of extradition, and it sounds like there was a lot of complicated red tape involved since she was a Canadian national. It doesn't look like the extradition ever went through, since conspiring to hide a stolen Mercedes is not exactly a high-priority crime, and I have no idea if she continued to maintain a relationship with Randall. But since she resided in San Felipe, and had no qualms about aiding Randall with his other crimes, there has been speculation that she may have been complicit, or at least had some knowledge, about Karen's disappearance. I know that Randall maintained that Karen's allegations against him being violent and abusive during their marriage were untrue, and that she was actually the abusive one, but his other criminal schemes really do not paint a flattering picture of his character. And while this may not have anything to do with this case, it's worth noting that Christopher Wright, Randall's son from her previous marriage, wound up being arrested in March of 2008 for spousal abuse and served 8 months in prison. So you get the impression that the apple may not have fallen too far from the tree. So the last confirmation of Karen being alive is when she phoned her mother and said she was heading to the vacation home in San Felipe to check if Randall had violated a court order by doing some construction additions to the residence before their divorce was finalized. I don't know if this means that Randall was already there performing construction when Karen arrived, but I can see how this could have led to a heated confrontation which escalated into violence. Sadly, if Randall did commit murder, he would have had ample time to cover his tracks since he did not report Karen missing for 3 days, so who knows where her body might be. Anyway, I'm not going to provide much commentary on the 1982 drowning death of Randall's 6-year-old stepson, Aaron Larson Wright, because there's such a limited amount of information available. Since it was initially ruled to be an accident, it does not sound like there was anything to arouse suspicion when it happened, and it was only after Randall's association with these cold cases came to light that investigators decided to give Aaron's death a second look. But an exhumation and a new forensic examination did not turn up any evidence of foul play, so for all we know, the whole thing may just have been a tragic drowning, and Randall's connection to it is just a coincidence. But of course, the disappearances of Paul Armstrong and Stephen Lombard cannot just be written off that way. During the first 15 years of media coverage on those two cases, there was no mention of Randall Wright, even though he definitely was questioned by investigators. So if the authorities ever suspected that he might have been involved, they never said so publicly. I previously mentioned that in April of 2009, the Merced Sun Star published details about a search warrant which was used to obtain Randall's DNA, and it contained an eyewitness account from a man named Jack Malone, who claimed that he saw Paul and Stephen enter a shed at the towing yard with Randall and another guy named Gary Barker, but he never saw the two missing men come out. Since a limited amount of information about this was only shared by one source, I have no idea who Jack Malone or Gary Barker are, but I'm guessing they were also employees at RTS Towing, and I found an online obituary which states that a Merced resident named Gary Barker passed away in July of 2016, so I'm under the impression this is the same guy. The information Malone shared sounds pretty damning, but I have no idea if investigators already knew this story back when Paul and Stephen first went missing, or if Malone only came forward after Randall started getting publicity over Karen's disappearance. But Malone's account is the only time Paul and Stephen have ever been placed together at the same location on the date they went missing. Obviously, this story did not lead to anyone being arrested for their roles in the presumed murders of the two men, so I'm guessing that investigators wanted to find other corroborating evidence before they filed charges. So now let's talk about the known facts about what took place on December the 17th, 1993. Even though Stephen was not scheduled to work that day, he was planning to go to RTS Towing to pick up his most recent paycheck and then later meet his wife to go Christmas shopping. It's been reported that Stephen did show up at the tow yard and was unable to pick up his check because of a clerical error, but no specific details have ever been shared about who provided that information to the authorities or how Stephen reacted to this news. If Stephen was unable to collect his check, I'm guessing he probably wouldn't have been too pleased, since he may have been planning to use that money for his Christmas shopping later that day. So yes, I can see how the situation might have led to a heated confrontation with Randall Wright. Now, the aforementioned article from the Merced Sun Star states that Jack Malone saw Gary Barker driving Paul Armstrong's truck away from the tow yard that day, but I think that might be an error, since I've never read anything about Paul owning a truck or having it go missing, and we know that Stephen's pickup truck was found abandoned in a Kmart parking lot the following morning. And obviously, since the truck was unlocked and had its keys in the ignition and a full cup of coffee in the holder, it seems very unlikely that Stephen would have left the pickup truck there in that condition. I guess the alternate possibility is that Stephen parked there and someone abducted him when he stepped outside, but it's also plausible that an outside party left the truck there to give off the false impression that something happened to Stephen at that location. The detail about the full coffee cup does come across as a bit staged, because if the story about Stephen driving to the towing yard and being murdered inside the shed is true, it doesn't make much sense for there to be a full cup of coffee inside his truck. I'd really like to learn more details about whether Stephen might have brought this coffee from his home or if it was purchased somewhere. It also sounds like investigators were unable to find any usable fingerprints inside the truck. Since Stephen was the owner, you'd assume that his prints would be all over it, so this suggests that someone else wiped the whole thing clean. But while there is a logical scenario to explain Stephen showing up at the towing yard that day, the detail which cannot be easily explained is how Paul might have wound up there. As you recall, Paul had spent the previous 2 months on disability because of a serious workplace injury, and his left leg was in a brace, and he still required crutches in order to get around. So I get the impression that he was not capable of driving himself anywhere. According to his girlfriend Colleen, Paul was still in bed when she left at 7:45 a.m., but when his stepbrother Ray stopped by the residence 1 hour later, Paul was gone. In some of the earliest articles about this case, Paul's family expressed their belief that he might have been abducted since his wallet was left behind, but his house keys, lighter, and a pack of cigarettes were not there. I'm not sure if Paul would have gotten the opportunity to grab those items if he was taken from the residence by force, so I wonder if someone showed up there to give him a ride, and since Paul wouldn't have been driving, he may have elected not to take his wallet. Stephen's appearance at the tow yard took place sometime between 9:30 and 10 a.m., so theoretically, if he picked up Paul at his residence and drove him to the tow yard, the timeline would match up. It's been reported that even though they both worked for the same employer, Stephen and Paul were not friends, but what if they had started communicating with each other about issues that were going on at RTS Towing? Both men's spouses have reported that they each appeared to be scared or depressed about something prior to their disappearances, but were not very communicative about what was going on, and Paul supposedly made mention of his co-workers being involved in illegal activity. The story provided by Jack Malone is that Randall Wright was upset that Paul and Stephen had filed a complaint against him with the Employment Development Department, which would make sense, given that Paul was on disability at that time, and he may have felt that his employer was liable for the injury he suffered on the job. In May of 2010, Randall agreed to give an interview to the media where he denied having any involvement in both men's disappearances and claimed that he had no knowledge of them having filed a complaint or an insurance claim against his company. Well, I'm sure that sort of thing would have been pretty easy to verify, but the authorities have never publicly confirmed if they found anything to corroborate these allegations. Jack Malone claims that after Randall and Gary Barker left the shed at the tow yard, Randall drove back in there with his Lexus sedan, and when he exited again, he drove off the property and did not return for at least 4 hours. So the implication seems to be that Randall was loading Paul and Stephen's bodies into his car and went to dispose of them somewhere, and Barker also used this opportunity to abandon Stephen's pickup truck. It's not an implausible scenario, but if it is true, I can only imagine what could have been so bad that Randall felt he had to commit a double murder. And without knowing anything about Barker's background, I have to wonder what would compel him to go along with something like this. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm really not sure if the authorities had any suspicions about Randall from the very beginning, or if they only started looking at him in a different light once he became a person of interest in his estranged wife's disappearance, but I do get the impression that they know a lot more than they've let on. Given that Randall wound up filing a $15 million civil lawsuit once his involvement in Karen's case made the news, you can understand the reluctance investigators might have had to go public about their suspicions involving these disappearances. But if Randall did kill Stephen and Paul in order to cover up some shady stuff which was taking place at RTS Towing, then it's pretty ironic that his business would end up going under 15 years later because of another missing persons case which had nothing to do with his company. So in the end, this is a story which raises a lot more questions than answers. Given his criminal history, I'm confident in believing that Randall Wright is not a good guy, but if he was responsible for the murders of all three of these missing individuals, then this would technically make him a serial killer. Back in 2009 and 2010, I think the families of the two missing men were hopeful that Karen Wright's disappearance was going to lead to some new revelations for their cases, but it looks like the investigation has once again reached a standstill and there have been no new developments for over 10 years. The combination of these three cold cases has created a massive jigsaw puzzle where all the pieces have not quite been put together yet, but what that might require is for the right person to come forward. So if you happen to have any information on the disappearances of Paul Armstrong, Stephen Lombard, and Karen Wright, please contact the appropriate authorities. As I mentioned, Karen's disappearance is technically under the jurisdiction of the Mexican authorities, but the primary contact for all three of these cases is the Merced County Sheriff's Office, which can be reached at 209-385-7445. That's 209-385-7445. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about a famous case from Unsolved Mysteries where a woman named Stephanie Booker had her face slashed by a propeller in a hit-and-run incident involving a speedboat, and the perpetrators were never identified. In addition, we've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries, the unexplained 1989 death of Russell Evans. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Giovanni A., Kev, Abigail B., Haley A., and Kristen L. Thank you all so much for your support. Another reminder that provided that it is safe enough to travel there, I'm hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you'd like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COOL22. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COOL22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Yeah.